Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on 12 Years a Slave, the new Steve McQueen movie. And joining me in the Slate studios in New York is Aisha Harris. Hello, Aisha.
Hi.
And Forrest Wickman. Hi, Forrest.
Hey, Dana.
You guys are both culture bloggers for Slate, contributors for Slate. You're also both knee-deep right now in the slave narrative on which this movie is based. So before we get started, well, very first, I'm going to ask you for a quick reaction, and then I want you guys to give us a little bit of background on the true story that this movie is based on. So we saw this together last night, and it's funny. Usually coming out of a movie with people that I'm planning on spoiling it with the next day, we have to kind of restrain ourselves from over-talking it and sort of say, all right, hold it back, save it for the spoiler. And this time, because of the nature, I think, just of the content of the movie, nobody seemed inclined to talk about it at all. So I really have no idea what you guys' reaction was. So you want to give me just a quick reaction?
Yeah, this movie left me pretty wrecked. I think it's pretty devastating. I think it's great and somewhat because there's not a lot else, in my opinion, pretty easily, you know, the greatest big American movie about slavery. And, you know, as going into it as a McQueen movie, I like his first two movies, I think, more than most people. And this is not as, like, aesthetically overwhelming as his previous movies, but I think it's good that he holds back a little bit and doesn't, you know, risk aestheticizing it too much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I definitely want to talk a little bit about his last two movies and set up who Steve McQueen is, not the car racing
right.
movie star, but the
yeah.
filmmaker. For those who haven't seen one of his first two movies, which were much smaller releases and are mm-hmm. less likely to have been seen by our listeners than this one. Aisha, what about you?
Yeah, it was very, very just... That was how I felt yesterday, was I couldn't even say anything. I was like, I don't know how I'm reacting. I'm feeling all these emotions. I haven't seen Hunger or Shame yet. This is my first Steve McQueen movie. I find it interesting that you said that it's not as aesthetically overwhelming, because when I went back and thought about it, I just had all of these very specific images and kind of pictures in my head that just stuck with me. And maybe they might not have been, like, very overwhelming, but or at least aesthetically, but emotionally, I think that they kind of stuck with me. So... Yeah.
Yeah, I should say, if you haven't seen a Steve McQueen movie, that's very relative. This movie is pretty stylish, but his first couple movies are very stylistically bold, with many, many more long takes than this movie has. I remember one of the criticisms of his first movie, Hunger, which is about the hunger strikes in Ireland, also with Michael Fassbender, was that he aestheticizes even like the like shit that's smeared across the wall in one of the cells, almost as if it's a painting or something. And that guy was a revolutionary, so it's maybe somewhat less objectionable in that case. But I don't think he does that kind of thing here. So
yeah,
much.
I mean, I think before this movie, I had pretty much not liked Steve McQueen as a director. I had regarded him primarily as a delivery system for Michael Fassbender, mm-hmm. who I discovered in Hunger
yeah.
in his debut film, and who is in this movie as well, and who works with him incredibly. I think they work incredibly well together. But those movies were too painterly to me. They were too painterly and aestheticized. And there's something... We'll get to whether or not this happens in this movie at times, but there's something about Steve McQueen's relationship to his audience that's a little bit sadistic at times. How much can you take?
Mm-hmm,
you know,
totally.
And watching Michael Fassbender slowly starve to death in Hunger is sort of an example of that.
Yeah, I do think that makes somewhat more sense in this movie. So you asked in part, I also want to get your full reaction to this movie. Very quickly, you asked in part about putting this movie in the context of the slave narrative that it's based on. Surprisingly, one of my main reactions ended up being, and I suspect this is probably very different from what you guys' experience was, but seeing it, I was sort of surprised how restrained it felt to me for most of the first couple hours, because, you know, in the book, there's just constant whippings because that's just the reality of the life. And in this movie, the first time there's a big whipping, you don't really see it. Like, the camera holds on it, but you don't see, like, the welts and the flesh, like, coming off the back. And that's his back, and that's something I imagined reading the book. And so I felt like he did show some restraint and not really dwelling on the full horror of that until really the last horrible, horrible whipping in this movie.
Well, let's talk about the story that it's based on quickly. The story of Solomon Northup, the slave who was abducted from freedom and kept in slavery for 12 years. You just finished reading that
mm-hmm.
that narrative. And Aisha, you've been in touch with Henry Louis Gates, who was the historical consultant
yes.
for the movie.
Yes.
So, I mean, we don't have to get into splitting hairs about whether every fact was shown, but somebody coming to this movie saying, who the heck is Solomon Northup?
Mm-hmm.
Give them his story.
Yeah, it's the short answer is that almost everything you see in this movie, with only minor exceptions, is true, in some cases verbatim, from the book. And there's some, you know, questions about the accuracy of the narrative in academic circles. But I think that the broad outlines are widely considered to be true. So Solomon Northrup was a freedman in New York in the mid-19th century. His father was freed by his master, I believe also in New York, definitely in the northeastern United States. When his master died, he put it in his will to free him. So Northrup had been free all of his life and mostly lived in New York. And you
what
know,
did he work as? Because the movie doesn't say anything about that.
Yeah. He did work a little bit as a violinist outside of just the one engagement that he did in the movie. But I think mostly he did various things. So he did work on some sort of project on a river, you know, getting lumber down it or something, very much
that's
like
right.
he eventually
that.
Does in
right.
the movie, and he did yeah. later as a slave. And I think a lot of carpentry. So I don't remember exactly, but that kind of thing.
And so then what happens in the movie anyway, and tell me if this is true or not, is that he plays as a violinist part-time, and he contracts with these two white men who run some kind of traveling circus, kind of like mm-hmm. a sideshow, to come and accompany something on violin. And when that happens, if I understood the scene right, they drug his drink, right? And then he wakes up in a cell, shackled, and is subsequently taken down south.
Yeah, that was definitely the impression that I got. I mean, Forrest, you could speak to it more because you actually read the book, but it makes pretty clear in the film that, like, they're all sitting at the table, and there's, like, a moment where the two guys look at each other, kind of glance at each other, and then pour him more to drink, and he keeps drinking. And then later on, the imagery is, like, woozy, kind of dissolved-type things going on with the camera. And he feels sick and wakes up the next morning in shackles.
Yeah, and that is very much like the book. It is ambiguous in the book. Northrup never says for sure whether they were involved or whether he wakes up in shackles with this guy Birch, and whether it was just Birch or whether somehow he just got sick and I don't know exactly how, but was abducted in the streets or something. He never, you know, fully accuses those two guys, but they definitely seem suspicious considering they were making him drink. And he does, in the book, deny very strongly that it was just drunkenness. He says, you know, he had these horrible headaches and it was a sickness unlike just a hangover or something.
So he's subsequently, along with several other free blacks who've been kidnapped, and are taken down, sold at auction in the South.
I think not all of them were free. I got somewhat more of the impression that they had all been kidnapped in the movie and that they had been free. And I think some of them may have. So for example, Eliza, who's played by Adeparo Adeyeye, from Pariah, I think she had just been with a kinder master. So they had all been in the Northeast at the very least, and so their situations had been a lot better before they were sold to this really cruel guy who sold them south.
So we don't know, in fact, the status of the rest of the people that he basically wakes up with in shackles, right?
I don't think so. Because I think Eliza's character, she has that one monologue that they flash back to where she mentions that maybe she was married to her master or was sleeping with her. I didn't quite understand that part.
Yeah, so she was with a master who was much more kind, and this is all, as I recall, it's all in the movie just as it was according to Northrup. She was with a master who was much more kind. The mistress, I believe it was much less kind, and she eventually, you know, took them and said she was coming to give them their freed papers. But what she actually did was just to sell them to this cruel guy, Birch.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't mentioned yet that Solomon Northrup, the main character, is played by Chiwetel mm-hmm. Ejiofor, right? So as long as we're getting into the movie now, I guess maybe we can't go through and go through
right.
every single fact. But if there is a salient fact that you want to make a comment on as we go, please do, Forrest, because you're our Northrup fact checker here. So they all get taken down. Is it New Orleans where they're sold?
Yes. I believe it's New Orleans. They definitely end up in Louisiana.
Yeah, one of the slaves on the ship, I think, mentions that that's where they're going next. Was it Georgia where he originally was found in shackles?
So he's eventually told that his name is Platt and that he's from Georgia, which is the story that, you know, probably was given by those two guys to Birch. He was never actually in Georgia.
Okay.
Got yeah.
So they all find themselves down south. And the scene of the auction is one that I wanted to mention because I think it's one of the first moments that this movie really starts to set itself apart from other historical dramas. Just the way that this auction is filmed is quite unexpected. For one thing, it's in a house, which I found kind of odd. Mm-hmm. It's in kind of like a nice bourgeois house. And there's music, right? They've got him playing violin and I think another guy playing an instrument too. So there's this feeling about it that it's sort of like almost like a fine art auction or something.
Yeah.
There's also the fact that a lot of the slaves, I think most of them, are standing around naked. And I was wondering about that, too. Is it true that slaves were auctioned off naked? Because when you see old kind of Civil War etchings and things like that, people are usually on an outdoor kind of raised auction block in clothes. Maybe that was just the convention of portrayal at the time.
Yeah, that definitely happened. You know, as it's related in the book, they were clothed until they were asked in many, many cases to take off their clothes for sort of a closer inspection.
So the fact that they're naked, among other things, was one of the first moments for me that some Holocaust imagery was sort of invoked. You know, that in a lot of films about the Holocaust, there's that same contrast between the powerless naked and the powerful clothed. But then another thing that was really, I mean, unforgettable that I was thinking of this morning when I first woke up is the moment that the Eliza character is separated from her two children by Benedict Cumberbatch, right, who's the first of several masters who acquires the Chiwetel Ejiofor character. And the question of whether or not her two young children are going to be sold with her, and the way that was treated, it was just so remarkably unsentimental and harrowing. I mean, speaking of representations of the Holocaust in this movie, I mean, in Schindler's List, I'm not going to, you know, bag on Schindler's List here, but in Schindler's List, that moment of separating from the children, I think, would have been accompanied by swelling music. Mm-hmm. The camera would have been in close-up on the children's faces and the mother's face, and there's something so kind of cruel and austere in the way McQueen films it. There's no music, so that essentially the music is the sound of these screaming children reaching for their mother. It's the only kind of sound
you hear. The only music is the happy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, then,
right.
And
the
then,
very ironic.
Then Solomon starts sort of playing louder, presumably to kind of drown out the children's sounds. But also the camera doesn't even stay on them. It kind of moves away from the children, and you see the mother being taken away, and they're not even on screen. So it's just a really painful moment where the camera kind of enacts the separation itself.
That was one thing that really stood out to me throughout the entire film was his use of sound and the way, and especially in that scene where like the camera moves away from the women, the Eliza and her children, but you still hear them screaming in the background. And then later on, it kind of parallels her crying, that she eventually gets to the point where like she just can't stop crying once they've been moved to the next plantation away from her children. And when they're in a church, and like you just, it overlaps, like it goes from one scene and then you see that they're having their church session and she's still crying. It's just like, it was just very powerful in moving the way like these kind of isolated moments of sound were portrayed.
Yeah, I completely agree. The sound design is really sophisticated in this movie. And if the score is by Hans Zimmer, who's sort of often overused in movies, right?
The score
is beautiful.
Though.
It's really restrained.
Great.
It's basically a little four-tone piano theme that comes back again and again, but it's not overused. There's really a lot of scenes, including the very awful, hard-to-watch scene where he's sort of quasi-hung, right, where Northup is put in this noose, but his toes can still touch the ground, and he sort of inches from being hung. Basically, it's a punishment that the horrible Paul Dano character, who we'll get to later, inflicts on him. But during that scene, the only sound is the natural sound of the plantation, the voices of people going by, the crickets chirping.
The kids playing in the background as he's hanging. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
It was...
Yeah, they just can't do anything about him hanging there because they'll get in trouble. It's really horrible. Just one quick thing about the score while we're on it. I also loved the score. My one reservation about it is that it is almost exactly the same theme that four chord thing you mentioned. It's almost exactly the same four chords as both Inception and The Thin Red Line. He's just been using it over. Yeah, when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, weird, they're using the theme from Inception in this. And then I put that like in my post, and somebody in the comments was like, no, this is the theme from The Thin Red Line. And then I went back and listened, and I honestly could not tell what it was because they are so similar. And I think
Hans
it was...
Zimmer, one of Hollywood's foremost film composers, was plagiarizing himself.
Yeah.
It's a scandal.
Yeah, I mean, you know, John Williams did it on a lot of his best scores, too.
At any rate, it's very effective. And the way,
I think
it's played on violin a lot of the time, too, which kind of echoes his instrument. It's kind of like it's a very simple, sort of almost like a Civil War ditty sounding song. Other remarkable moments that you guys want to get to as he progresses through. So he goes to Benedict Cumberbatch, who sad to say, this guy who separates his children from the mother at the beginning is actually the kindest of the three or four masters that own him throughout the film.
Yeah, the movie's treatment of that character was pretty remarkable and also a significant difference from the book, in that in the book, Northrop says things like, this was the kindest, gentlest, you know, most Christian man I ever met. And he doesn't even just say in the South. He just says, like, this guy Ford couldn't possibly break out of his context. And you get the sense that he's clearly better than the other people in the movie, but he's, like, constantly undercut, and you constantly see his hypocrisy. Just like in that sort of brilliant use of sound you mentioned, Aisha, where he's giving his sermon, and it's, you know, this kind Christian sermon, but all you can hear in the background is Eliza's, you know, wails about being separated from her family. So I thought that was very powerful.
Yeah, I mean, for me, one of the things that really stood out from all the other slavery-themed movies that I've seen is that, like, it doesn't paint it in one broad stroke. You get all these dynamics of what slavery in the South looked like, because a lot of times you see either it's just a simple black and white, the masters are evil, 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 they're all, like, there's no hope for them, and then the slaves are, like, helpless and completely just victimized. And then in other cases, you see, if you're looking at blaxploitation films from the 1970s that are slavery themed, you see kind of these hypersexualized rape, what we would consider rape today, but, like, they kind of make it seem like, oh, the white master is in love with the black slave. And here you just get all these different nuances. You get all of those things, but there's no right or wrong, black or white. Every character has a flaw. Some are worse than others. Obviously, Epps's character,
Michael Fassbender's
character,
who's the second owner who gets him from Benedict Cumberbatch,
right, is by far he's the evil of the evil. But it just to me, and also the fact that Alfre Woodard's character, you see something like that, where this is a former black slave who decided that she would have a relationship with her white master, and now she kind of benefits from the fruits of that. And, like, you don't read about that in school. You don't read about the fact that people like Solomon Northup existed, that there were, in the mid-19th century, black Americans who did live well. And granted, they still face racism, obviously, but they not all of us were, you know, enslaved, and not all of us were destitute. There was a middle class, or a middle class within the black population.
And that's something that without ever being overly kind of underlined and made too salient, is really effectively developed in the movie, I think, which is his difference from the culture of slavery that he is kidnapped into, right? And one of the most powerful moments of that for me is after the burial. Mm-hmm. I forget the name of the guy who drops dead in the field. That's a horrible
scene. That's Dwight Howard's character,
yeah,
right? From Beast of the Southern Wild, the guy who played the father.
Yeah. That's right. He has a very small role. So he plays a slave who we don't really get to know at all until he just drops dead picking cotton one day. And after they bury him, they all gather together and sing this spiritual. And I just thought it was incredibly well communicated that wasn't Solomon Northup's culture. Mm-hmm. And there's a moment that he kind of starts to sing along. And it's both kind of inspiring and beautiful and horrible, because it's sort of a moment that he's giving himself over and saying, I am a slave now. I have only the pleasures of a slave. And I thought that moment was beautifully acted and really painful.
Yeah, totally agree. In the book, there's a similar process of him pretty clearly sort of becoming Platt in a lot of ways, and developing even, like, a fondness, because he's starving, for the little scraps that he gets. But yeah, it's like most of that work, I think, is put on that one scene, and is Adjia4 in particular is pretty amazing in that scene, I think. So yeah, just one quick thing about Dwight Henry, who I think we may have said is Dwight Howard, and then I'll realize that, you know, that's the basketball player. Wrong, Dwight H. I thought it was interesting how quickly he's dispatched with, and he's one of a lot of pretty recognizable characters in this movie who just come and go, and I feel like maybe some people could potentially view that as a weakness, and I do wonder if there's a lot more footage that wasn't used. But I also thought it was really powerful to have them very recognizable and then sort of totally, dehumanized or dispatched with so arbitrarily, and I thought you know, and that well, is what it was like for a lot of
people. Convention A. Wallace from Beasts of the Southern Wild is in there, and I didn't recognize her because, again, she is never shown in close-up. She plays Solomon Northup's daughter, who is essentially sort of a background kid, you know, so he really got some pretty big names for tiny roles.
Yeah. I don't think it's nearly as kind of distracting as, let's say, The Butler, where it's just kind of like we're going to trot out all these. And I think the level of stardom in here is not as A-list, you would say, or glitzy as The Butler. I feel like a lot of people who show up, Paul Giamatti, I believe Sal from Mad Men appears too.
Remember? I'm not a Mad Men watcher. So
are either of you Mad Men?
I'm a Mad Men watcher, but I don't know if I recognize
Sal. Sal was the main gay character for like the first two or three seasons.
Okay, I've missed some seasons.
Okay, so if I'm correct, he showed up as one of the very briefly as a slave owner. I think it's when after Epps's crops go bad and he brings them to that other guy. That was Sal, if I'm absolutely correct.
Yeah, but among the abductors is Taryn Killam from SNL, who's sort of surprising to see in a role like that.
That was so weird.
But you know, something that I really kind of appreciated, it almost seemed like a cruel joke on Steve McQueen's part, is just that essentially all the white characters in this movie disappear completely as soon as they're not useful anymore, right? I mean, exactly the way that black characters have traditionally been treated in Hollywood films. So every owner, every sort of the guy that says that he'll carry the letter for him and then betrays him, all these characters don't really get a chance to reappear and either, you know, apologize or suffer any sort of justice. They just drop out of the narrative entirely.
Yeah.
So we should maybe get to how Northup goes from Ford's plantation, the Cumberbatch plantation, to the main, you know, sort of last plantation where this movie spends most of the last 30 minutes or
which
so.
Which is Epps' plantation, which is owned by the Fassbender character.
Owned by Fassbender. It's a cotton plantation, which is, so it, very briefly, he has a conflict with this guy, Tibbetts, I think is how you say his name, who's played by Paul Dano.
In a feat of overacting, I might add.
Yeah, although I enjoyed it. I always like, Paul Dano is very polarizing, I think.
I'm not one of those haters. I'm not a Paul Dano hater at all, but I think he overacts significantly in this role.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Anyway, so he's sort of like a very, very lowly carpenter on this plantation, and so they get, and is also just like a horribly racist person, and so they get into fights, and eventually it becomes sort of untenable for Northup to be at the same plantation as him, which is how,
Sorry, manager, that was also one of my favorite moments, was his singing and clapping, that montage.
Real another song,
great,
apparently.
Yeah, another great use of sound, where you have, like, his I don't remember how the song went, but
it's Run, N-word, Run.
Oh, yeah.
And apparently it's a song that it comes off as, you know, very threatening in the movie, is how I took it. And I guess it was also, you know, popular amongst slaves and people of color.
Yeah.
Well, see, I'm going to sound the first note of dissent in this spoiler and say that I thought that moment was a little bit overplayed. There's a few moments, just aesthetically speaking, when I think McQueen kind of gilds the lily, and I think that was one of them, not the song itself. And maybe it was also that I think Dano was kind of, you know, like sinking his teeth a little bit too gleefully into the role of the racist overseer. But I thought that carrying that whole through the entire montage felt like a little bit of lily gilding.
Oh, I love it.
I could see that. I liked it. It was maybe more entertaining to me than it should have been to just have to watch such a villain. But maybe it didn't bother me quite as much because in the narrative, that character is like an incredible villain of history that it seems was really like that. And the same with Epps, who is actually even more horrible in the book, in the sense that the one thing you don't see in this movie that is probably the worst thing in the book is not just how much he whips, like, you know, all day long. He used to be an overseer, but I guess at night, in addition to getting drunk and making everybody dance, he would also just get all of the slaves up in the middle of the night and just start whipping them for fun.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
This book, I mean, if the book is more hardcore than the movie, I don't think I'm going to go and read it as I was previously.
It's not quite as, you know, viscerally shocking, but it's very awful.
I mean, I guess you just don't visually see it unfolding before you, but the descriptions sound pretty terrible. I mean, Fassbender really speak about not overacting. I mean, I think he's really, really intense in that role of this psycho slave owner, but there's not a moment that I feel he's chewing the scenery. I just felt like he was a very alive, present actor who also, as he does in Shame really well too, kind of is good at telegraphing a sort of counter emotion with his eyes. You know, you sort of see the part of him before he was essentially corrupted by slavery that might have been a sympathetic person.
Yeah.
He has great drunk acting in this, too, I will quickly say. Like, he's very good at, I don't know how he does it, but his eyes, you know, totally go glassy when he's wasted in the middle of the night.
We should talk about his toxic relationship with the slave, Patsy, which is really the central, aside from anything involving Chiwetel Ejiofor's character, is really the central relationship of the movie.
Okay, well, Patsy is played by, and forgive me if I say this incorrectly, Lupita Nyong'o. And she, to me, was amazing in this role. And her character kind of serves as the one slave in the house who the mistress, or she's not the mistress, the wife of Epps. And I cannot remember the actress's name.
It's Sarah Paulson.
Sarah Paulson. Yeah. Who just envies her because she knows how much that Epps lusts after her. And there's that great scene where she tells him, like, you're either going to, like, beat her, get rid of her, or whatever, or I'm going. And Epps is like, well, I will let go of you before I let go of her. And she just kind of serves as this very, I don't want to say tragic, but it is kind of, it read to me very tragic, but not in that kind of melodramatic way, like in this very realistic way that, or how would I know? I did not live during slavery, but it seemed to be very humanistic. And her scene, especially with Solomon's character, where she asks him to kill her.
Oh my God, that scene was really hard to watch.
It was so hard to watch. And after that happened, after everything that happens after that, especially that climactic whipping after she went to the other plantation to get some soap because she wanted to clean herself because the mistress won't let her bathe because she's so jealous of her. When she comes back and Epps whips her, like, I just kept thinking, you should have just killed her. You should have just killed her when she asked you.
I thought she was going to die in that scene. I was really, really afraid that when he makes Solomon whip her, that would be like the fatal blow and that he would have killed her.
Right. So did I. Because I felt like it kind of set it up for that, where it's like, I refused to kill you then, but I thought maybe he was like, well, I'll just do it now, even though to me that's worse than what she asked him to do, which was like slit her throat and drown her. But I couldn't help but during that whipping scene, especially right after when they're cleaning off her bruises and she's screaming, there's one moment where you get a close-up of Solomon and he has, like, one tear. And immediately I went to, like, this is like Glory.
Glory.
This is like Glory. But, like, so much more harrowing because if I remember Glory correctly, like, you never see his back. Or if you do, it's not nearly as, like, bloody. Like, in this film, you see there's just, like, a very short moment where you see him whipping her and you see the flesh just, like, flying off. And I was just like, wow. I couldn't help but compare it to Glory and to Django Unchained and Roots and every other slavery-themed movie I've seen, because they do have that common theme, but this just felt... It just hit me in a way that none of those other movies ever did.
I think
why is that? I know, I completely agree. And you don't have a sense that I don't know how I would characterize the feeling in maybe a Roots whipping scene, but you don't have the feeling that you're being served some kind of, like, symbolic lesson, right? I mean, you really have the feeling that you're witnessing human suffering.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there are a lot of reasons for it. First of all, I don't actually know how they filmed that sequence. It's like the second big bravura sequence of the whole movie after the slave auction, in the sense that it's another really, really long shot. And including all of that, I guess, makeup work, maybe they use CGI, I don't know, to show her the flesh, like, flying off her back. In the book, it is described as by far but the worst whipping he ever sees. He describes her as being, quote, literally flayed. And so you get that same sense. And I do think part of it, too, is that the movie doesn't show the flesh flying off the back, as I said earlier, for the other scenes, you know, when that guy breaks his paddle over Northup's back earlier and then takes out the cat. You just see, you know, him flinching. And I think that's mostly what you see in Glory, too. I think there are a lot of reasons where it really, really... I mean, I felt a lot of people... It heard a lot of people sniffling during that scene.
I will say that I think there was another tiny, tiny moment of directorial overkill at the end of that scene. I mean, how much more horrible can it be than what you've already witnessed with the whipping of Patsy's character? But then when he cuts to the soap on the ground to remind you that it was all about soap, that just seemed like a moment of, you know, just putting in a final nail that didn't really need to be put in.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the other big, like, stylistic moments, which I really liked, it came right after that, and I suspect maybe you wouldn't have liked it because it is a little more showy, is we get this long shot of Northup where he's looking around, and then eventually he just turns, and he basically looks at the camera, I think, several seconds.
Are you talking about the shot, the close-up of his face after he sent the letter with the Bradford
character?
Yeah,
it's right
around that. Oh, I loved that shot.
Loved it, too. Yeah. And it was, yeah, I mean, it just felt like all of a sudden he turned at the audience and looked at the audience, looked at me. And, you know, at that moment, I had this real, like, I kind of only realized it afterwards, but it was like, that was Northrop looking at me. That was not Chiwetel Ejiofor. And that's an amazing trick to pull off, I think. But both for, you know, McQueen and Ejiofor.
It's very bold to ever have a character look directly at the camera, and that's only for a second of that shot that he does, but I thought that shot was really powerful. And the movie, I'm glad that it ended where it did end, which we'll get to, but I think it could also have effectively ended right there.
Real quick, what did you guys think of Brad Pitt in that role?
Well, we should briefly say who he is. So, so in this lineup of interchangeable white dudes that keep coming in and out of Solomon's life, he is the last and the first one to really offer him any help whatsoever. So he's this kind of Amish-looking dude, although they never say that he is Amish.
Yeah, he's from Canada.
He's from
Canada. Have an odd beard where he has this thick, brushy beard all around his cheeks and then like
hat.
A very neatly shaved mustache area.
And for reasons that aren't clear, he's actually working for Michael Fassbender's character as well, for Epps, right? He's helping to construct this little house on the property.
The historical person apparently was named Bass, and he was a carpenter. He was from Canada and was, you know, you get the sense, pretty much the only guy in the South who was an abolitionist. And he's described as a contrarian who he can get around in the South because he's, like, very charming about the way he argues. And people think he's not really sincere, that he's just arguing that black is white for its own sake. But you know, he puts his money where his mouth is eventually and mails the letter for.
Right. So he is essentially the agent finally of Solomon being able to get out, because his free papers are then brought down by a white man that he knows from up north. And we don't really get the details of exactly how legally he's gotten out of there. Right. But he's
It took months and months and months. That Bass guy even was going to just go up to New York himself because they weren't getting any responses. So there's a lot that's elided there, almost more than anywhere. But nothing really important, I would say.
Well, wait. What did you think of Brad Pitt, Aisha?
Yeah.
So I guess I kind of got to the point once his character showed up and I realized that he was a real character. That scene he had with Epps, where he's talking about how, you know, the black people should be treated the same and everything. At first, it felt a little too after school special to me. But overall, I kind of looked at it from a bigger perspective, and especially this idea of the, if we want to talk about it, the exceptional Negro, if you want to get into that. I don't know if we do.
Yeah, let's close on talking about that.
Okay, so there have been some who have criticized Solomon Northup's story as kind of promoting this idea of the exceptional Negro, because there are very few slave narratives by slaves who were free and then sold into slavery. Most of them are slaves who were born into it and then were trying to get out. And so there's this perception that perhaps, like, And throughout the movie, there are instances where it kind of feels like he says, like, I'm not supposed to be here. Like, I'm free. And, like, he says at one point something along the lines to Brad Pitt's character, actually, is like, if justice was served, I wouldn't be here, or something along those lines. And you get to the question of, like, well, is this a movie that's supposed to, be meant for the masses and meant to say slavery was bad for everyone? Or is it supposed to say that some slaves deserved it and some people shouldn't have been there, like they were free already? And I struggled with that while I was watching the movie. But then when I thought about it, there were all these moments that don't apply to that. And the fact that you kind of see Solomon go through this kind of realization, like, no, I am just another nigger. Like, this is how they treat me. And he kind of goes through that transformation over time and suddenly just kind of, I think McQueen handled it and Ejiofor handled it really well in terms of, like, making him realize, like, I am, in their eyes, I am no different and we are kind of all the same. So
indeed, he was hiding his education and his real identity throughout most of the movie, right, for fear of being singled out for being exceptional.
Exactly.
Yeah, I totally agree. That was one of the biggest concerns I had going into this movie, and I thought it just really pulls it off so well. How he becomes, and I guess the other concern I had is that, you know, this is also one of the few stories about slavery that ends happily, you could say. But, you know, getting to the end of the movie, when he gets back, and maybe you guys had a different read on this, maybe it was different for me having read the book, but the movie, to me, didn't play it as, like, this big, happy reunion so much. But it's mostly the main thing I got out of the final scene, and this is not the emphasis in the book, but I think it is the right place for this movie to end. It's just the loss of those 12 years. So you see, you know, how his daughter has grown up so much that she now, this little girl, this person who was a little girl, has her own son who's named Solomon. And
The fact he's just named Solomon and he repeats the name.
Yeah,
oh my God.
Right out of the book too. So it just ended up, and he keeps talking about, like, I'm sorry for the bitterness of this moment, but this is very bitter for me. And I think that's the note to end on for this movie, not like, well, and then racism ended.
Yeah, the end is one of the most devastating things in the movie, even though it is ostensibly happy. I mean, it couldn't be happier in a way, right? This entire time you've seen him longing for his family, and the last shot is literally just his family in a group hug, you know, just like in this huddle, all sobbing together. And I think the very last lines of the movie are him saying, forgive me, and his wife saying, there's nothing to forgive. Right. Yeah. And you're just, I mean, the entire audience, I'm sure, was just like in a puddle at that point. But at the same time, there's not any sense of resolution or justice, including in the little legends that happen afterwards that tell the rest of the story of Solomon Northup, right, who ended up going on the lecture circuit as an abolitionist, but who never found justice against his kidnappers or against his owners.
Yeah, it wasn't even allowed to testify against them as a black man.
And that had to do with where he had been abducted, or... Do you know in the north of England?
I mean, it's as it happens in the book, but I didn't know, like, the legal rules of the time enough to know whether that was just because of the state or whether it was
Another remarkable thing is that the very last legend you see is that the time and circumstances of his death are not known, which, given that, you know, as you say, Aisha, I mean, he was kind of an exceptional case that became this kind of famous, you know, lecturer on slavery and abolition, it's just a moment that you realize that, you know, even the most important black man in the mid-19th century was not important enough to go down in history. All right. Well, this has been an extremely long spoiler, but a really interesting one. But I think we should wrap it up soon. I think we should at least nod, as tacky as I feel even mentioning this, to the fact that this movie is being positioned as a big Oscar contender. And I'm just wondering what you guys think both about, you know, its possible reception among audiences. Is this going to play? I mean, we talked about The Butler when The Butler came out. You and I spoiled it, Aisha. And that's so much more of a crowd pleaser and so much more of like a – leaves you so much more of an up place than this movie. At the same time, I think this movie is really powerful and could have really, really wide appeal. Anyway, I'm just wondering what you all think of that, and if you can imagine Lupita Nyong'o in a couture gown at the Oscars.
Right.
It's really, really strange to imagine a movie that sort of, you know, goes this deep into the raw, you know, suffering of slavery being, you know, on the Hollywood gossip circuit, but it's going to be.
Yeah, and I mean, these movies have also done really, really well. So I hope this is, as you said, is definitely darker than The Butler and less entertaining than Django Unchained, as horrifying as that movie can be at times. But it, and in some ways, is very close to Schindler's List, which was basically a blockbuster. So I hope that it catches on like that. This doesn't have as uplifting an ending as Schindler's List, and it's better for it. But, you know, I do think that Fassbender and this movie and those two supporting actresses, maybe both, have...
And she would tell Edgefor as well?
And Edgefor, yeah, definitely. Sorry. I think they have nominations coming their way, at least.
Yeah, I agree. I'll be curious to see how the media responds to it in terms of, like, I feel like unlike Django Unchained and a lot of other movies, this might be difficult for people to try to parody or try to, you know, make fun of because it's just so... so harrowing. And one person behind me at the movie theater, a couple seats behind me, old guy was just like, right after, he was like, I think I told you guys this, and I tweeted this. He was like, oh man, like I couldn't even stand all this for 12 minutes, much less 12 years. And I was like, well, I don't really know how to feel to that response, but I guess after seeing that, you're going to respond in some way. And that was the way it was just kind of like, not really appropriate, but I guess honest reaction to all of this.
You're being too kind towards that reaction. I think that that reaction sucks. There's a great scene in the movie where one white man is lowered to slavery, and he's just complaining to Northrop for a couple minutes about how hard his day was, and Northrop is just listening to him and kind of seething. And it's a great scene of like white privilege in this movie,
right? And the guy not acknowledging at the end when he says, "And all I want to do is earn an honest wage and get out of here," right?
Yeah,
and then just like the cut
totally
to Chiwetel's
oblivious
face after that, yeah. Okay, well, guys, thank you for suffering through this movie with me and coming here to talk about it. And I hope we spoil something again very soon.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks, Dana.
All right. Our producer is Chris Wade. Our executive producer is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.